Hello, welcome to the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast, where we talk philosophy from the farm. I'm your host, Terrence Lahue. Today, I'm joined by Scott Hebert from Flavorful Farms in Chilliwack, British Columbia. Together, we'll be talking about our top three books of the year and our favorite narrators of the year. We've got a good little selection of books here, and I highly recommend that everyone check them out. So, without further preamble, let's get on with the show. Scott Hebert, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, well, everyone's listening to this after Christmas, so even though this is before Christmas, I have to ask, how was your Christmas?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I just worked out and spent time with the family, ate a little bit too much food, but overall it was pretty good. How about you?
I think it went absolutely wonderful. I tried to work out and then completely forgot about it. I said I wasn't going to eat much, and then I looked at more cookies, and thank goodness cranberry sauce is on sale in November because I stocked up on a lot of it.
Nice.
Do you guys celebrate Boxing Day in Canada?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, big sales. It's bigger. Our Boxing Day used to be bigger than it used to be our Black Friday.
Okay.
Yeah. But then your Black Friday started taking off like 10 years ago, and then all our marketing switched over to that.
Well, I know that's also the holiday I'm looking forward to, but that's neither here nor there. Scott, today we are here to talk about books. Oh, wonderful books. We've each selected three books and a narrator. And Scott, why don't you start? We're picking three of the most impactful books we've read this year. They weren't necessarily published in 2019, but they were ones we read in 2019. So what is your first pick?
Over the past 3 or 4 years, I've read more and more books every single year, but this year was a lot different for me. I tried to only read books that really grip me, and my first book is Every Tool is a Hammer by Adam Savage. He's the Mythbusters guy. He's the redheaded one, and he's a prop maker, a model maker, and it's just a really great book. It was just profiles his life, and it profiles what a maker is, and then he gives you lots of tips and tricks about making things and about using different tools and different glue. And it's just really cool. There's all these life lessons that he's learned through making. And it was just a very inspiring book. Like, I felt there was a part in it at the very end that talks about doing a project where you take cardboard and you make a scale model of a room that you live in. And I'm building a tiny house right now, and so I thought that'd be a good exercise to do. So right after I finished the book, I went and made a cardboard model of my tiny house that I'm building, and it was just a really impactful book on me this year.
I grew up watching Mythbusters, so it's amazing that I have not read this yet. I've heard you talk about it before. I really do need to sit down and read it. Adam Savage was always the funnier one on the show, and I can only imagine that he would write a fantastic book.
Yeah, and he's got a really good YouTube channel too that I've watched quite a bit on over the past couple of years. He does like One Day Builds, he calls them. He's got a good series called One Day Builds. Sometimes he'll mod a Nerf gun, or he'll build some type of prop. But he always tries to get it done in like one day, and it's just like they're like 20 or 30 minute videos, but they're really interesting. And I didn't even know he was writing a book, and then when it came out, I was just like, it was just one of those times that I was just like, oh, this is my guy. Like, I didn't even really know what making was or the making community or anything. And I was just like, I am this thing. I am like a maker. Like, I just love making things. Like, I love, whether it's videos or podcasting or building a tiny house or building a farm, like, I have to be making something. I love doing that. And this book just kind of really showed me a lot more as what possible. And it just makes me aspire to be more, I guess.
Does he give a definition of a maker?
I think so, but I listened to an audiobook version, so I don't have it with me off the top of my head. Yeah, just someone who likes to make things. Like, it could be anything. Like, lots of these guys go into prop and model making just because they want to have the, like, some people are fascinated by objects, and they, Adam Savage, actually, he's got a really good TED talk about making this Maltese Falcon from some old movie. I forget what movie it is.
The Maltese Falcon.
Oh, is that what it is? But he makes like a scale model of it and 3D prints it. And he's like, it's this crazy it's this crazy journey of him doing this thing. And, he really likes having those objects. And I think that's for him is a big part of why he likes making things. Cause he sees these objects and stuff on movies and he wants to possess them. But for me, I just like making stuff. Like, honestly, I don't need the stuff afterwards. I just really like making stuff. I think it's fun. I think it's fun to develop these different skills and skill sets and put them all together to make something beautiful and, or functional or both.
Mm-hmm. Again, a book that now I'm definitely going to have to read. I think I also heard he made an Iron Man suit.
Oh yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I'd seen that come up. I think that Iron Man suit was actually made by a whole collaboration of different people, and he was just kind of the face of the project. I think it was in collaboration with a couple different universities and stuff. I think there was actually quite a few people that went into it, but yeah, he was definitely, yeah, they made an Iron Man suit.
So my first pick is Education of a Wandering Man by Louis L'Amour.
Okay.
If for those not familiar, Louis L'Amour is the author of a lot of Western books, like those small paperbacks that your grandfather has, that he wrote most of those. And a lot of those books actually became films or Western TV shows back in the old days. Hondo, starring John Wayne, is based on a Louis L'Amour novel. But I found a copy of his memoir, Education of a Wandering Man, at a Half Price Books. And basically, it's a memoir of his reading. It's like him just cataloging. I started reading this, and I read that, and I read that. And it's just the kind of book that works for me on so many different levels. He has a story in it that I love because I'm largely self-educated. And so it's really fascinating to get to read about someone who basically chronicles their self-education. And he actually told a story where when he was traveling back in the day where hitchhiking wouldn't result in murder-suicide. And he was hitchhiking. This guy pulled over, taking him to the small town. It's a college professor of some philosophy, whatever. And L'Amour turns to him, he's like, oh, well, blah, 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 blah. And he starts conversing with him educatedly on the professor's topic, challenging him on those topics. And he describes the professor slowly becoming horrified at seeing this drifter who he does not expect to understand anything, discussing Weber or any of the other philosophical whatevers. I sound so smart when I say that, don't I? But it's just one of those stories that I have to say I appreciate because we often make that mistake of perceiving someone as less well-educated just because they read the stuff themselves.
Is this guy like a homeless guy or what?
L'Amour? No. He was a very successful author in his time, but he traveled and basically was a bum for a number of years. Not necessarily bum, but, you know, back in the day and age where the rugged individual would travel across the West, okay, thumbing his ride.
Yeah, cool.
In my best Sam Elliott voice possible. Ironically enough, actually, one of his books got turned into a TV show starring Sam Elliott, but that's neither here nor there. That's my first pick.
What year is this guy traveling in?
Oh, I've got the book here. It was early America. By early, I mean he still met people that knew Billy the Kid.
Nice.
1930.
Nice.
I mean, that's just one of the years. From 1930, 1935, and 1937 is the list of... He also has in the back a bibliography of all the books he can remember having read in those years, books and plays.
How many books is there? Lots?
Well, there's like 8 pages.
Crazy.
Of list format. 84 listed for 1937, 73 listed for 1936. So yeah, I mean, a vast amount, more than I probably would have remembered. He has 105 listed for 1933.
That's wild.
I can't imagine reading that many books in a year. So what's your second pick?
My second pick is Range by David Epstein.
Ooh, that name sounds familiar.
Yeah, not Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh, that...
Yeah, it's the wrong year to be named Epstein.
It snuck onto the podcast. How?
So, Range, it's subtitled Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard of like the 10,000 hour rule. And then if you put 10,000 hours in and you work on things, that you'll eventually be a master or very competent in that field. But this kind of dumps that on its head a little bit in the sense that he divides things up into fixed domains or what he calls wicked domains. So a fixed domain would be something like golf or chess, where the rules are fixed. And as long as you stay within those rules, doing all these reps and repetitions are going to lead to success. But in wicked domains, something like podcasting or being on YouTube or lots of mostly other things, it's better to be a generalist because you have more skills to bring to the table. You have a deeper skill set. And it was really interesting. It was just a different way to look at some information that I've been presented with. And I also feel that I am a generalist. Like, I've always thought that. And it takes a long time to get traction going sometimes when you are a generalist, mm-hmm. because you're kind of not like a jack of all trades, master of none type of thing. It's at the beginning, it's better to be a master of one thing. But if you can get to a point where all your skill sets are pretty good, it's better to be a generalist. So it was just it was a really neat book. It was kind of a little bit confirmation bias for some things I was already hoping were true. Uh-huh. But yeah, no, I really liked it. It was a good book.
It sounds interesting. I'll have to give it a read. What I love about books like that is that it really does focus on, let's look, for example, Leonardo da Vinci was a master painter, yeah. but he did dabble in a lot of other things, and he brought those skills and talents to his main talent of art, to his main work of art.
Yeah,
perhaps you can correct me on that, because you read Walter Isaacson book.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. He, like, the one thing about Da Vinci is that he was really brilliant. Da Vinci and Michelangelo were around the same time, and Michelangelo was a great sculptor, and Da Vinci was also a very good sculptor. But when Michelangelo went to go paint, Da Vinci thought that his paintings were flat. And that's because that even though Michelangelo knew the human form and could detail the beautiful curvature of the human body and everything, like his humans would look very beautiful and proportional, and everything was correct about them, he didn't get the lighting right because he didn't have enough skills painting. But Da Vinci had done sculpting, and he had done all sorts of work with painting with light. He'd actually developed this one technique, I believe it was called stemmato, where you kind of, when you're looking at something, usually things don't have a sharp edge on them in real life if you're looking at something in the distance. And so he found a way to soften the edge, and it was called stemmato. And it's just pretty much the way the light bounces off an object. And Michelangelo didn't really have like any of that. And so Michelangelo was like a specialist in the sense that he was very much more of like a sculptor, but Da Vinci, yeah, he was more of a generalist. And he had so many different skills, from doing like military stuff to all this painting, sculpting. And when he put something together, it was really something to behold.
Again, the nice thing about doing this is I get more books to read. Thank you. You have added to the pile.
There you go.
My next book is The Alter Ego Effect by Todd Herman. And I've got the book here so I can actually read the subtitle. The Power of Secret Identities to Transform Your Life. Now, obviously, that's a title that makes it sound like it's one of those woo-woo books. It's not. The guy, Todd Herman, is from an athletics background. He's a sports performance coach, basically. And in essence, what he's done is this is the problem with trying to describe this book. It's a idea that once you understand it is very simple, but not necessarily the easiest to explain. Regardless, I decided it was the book that I was picking to try explaining to people. Basically, it's the idea of taking inspiration from a person, figure, or idea to increase your performance. In essence, cool. Think of it like, the example he uses is Dr. Martin Luther King. He didn't need to wear glasses. But okay. He did wear glasses that had just clear eyes in it because he thought the glasses made everyone think he was smarter.
Right.
Which science has actually proven that's the way it works.
Yeah.
So in essence, the idea of using the alter ego is basically stepping out of the fixed version you think of your identity in. For instance, I can say, well, T does not do sports. T is not an athletic person. But what if for a moment I said, I'm going to act like Peyton Manning? How would Peyton Manning approach sports? He's a sports guy, I think. I don't know much about sports.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He does play sports. Yeah.
So it's that general idea. And they've done, he has all the different studies in there. He even talks about enclosed cognition, which I find fascinating. It's basically when they did a study, they had people wear lab coats. And they said, well, you're wearing a doctor's coat. And when they did that, they took this test. It showed that the group had better logic, better cognitive function, basically, better, quicker results. In essence, a little bit smarter than the control group. Then they had another group wear the exact same smocks, the exact same lab coats, but said it's a painter's smock. And that group scored better in creativity than the control group, because you're a painter, you're going to be more creative. Or at least that's the idea. So it's an interesting idea that I've really enjoyed, because for me personally, I've used this from time to time quite unwittingly when I'm just like, I'm nervous in a situation, let me, how would famous movie actor, how would John Wayne act in this situation?
Nice.
And then I do my best to do my best John Wayne impression without doing a horrible, horrible vocal impression.
Nice. Yeah, it might be hard to do. No, it sounds really interesting. So I'm going to add that one to my list, or to my wish list.
The audiobook is actually also narrated by him, so I do recommend that.
Yeah, that's always nice. I always like it when the author reads it himself.
He has the right voice for it, is what I'm going to say. Good. Contrary to, unfortunately, some other people. So what's your next pick, Scott?
I guess my next one, this is one I just added today. It's an obscure one. So I've been going back to martial arts since the beginning of last January. I started doing Muay Thai, and this one coach that I follow, he coaches a whole bunch of UFC guys. His name's Dwayne Lidwig. He had posted this book that someone had written, and it just had like a really nice sentence in it. He just outlined, like, he just took a picture of it and put it on Instagram, and I thought it was awesome. So this one's called Warrior in the Garden by Nobuyage. And it's just a short little book, but, and it's about the way of the samurai. And there was a samurai Bushido code that these warriors followed. It was like, it was how they were supposed to act in all these situations and stuff. And, I found it super interesting, and I just read it in the morning every day for like 15 minutes until I was done. It's just like a 100-page book or whatever. But yeah, I found it super interesting, and I just really loved it. And it was kind of more about almost using Bushido in like modern day life, and just about how martial arts can like change people's lives, and how it, like, what you get out of it. He's a Japanese guy, but moved to America, and he did a whole bunch of different martial arts, but now he pretty much just does jiu-jitsu. And I believe he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. But yeah, it was it was one of those books. I was just like, I love this right now.
That's awesome. I haven't done much martial arts myself. However, I have several friends who are advanced in martial arts, and they enjoy it. And again, he's not that athletic, so I just smile and go, that sounds great. But I've always enjoyed getting a chance to talk with them about more of the mental game in martial arts, because really a lot of it is, and you can correct me on this, but a lot of it is not only developing muscle memory, but also you're developing a respect for what your actions mean and do.
Yeah, totally. There's a lot to it. There is a lot to it, because, like, I mean, mostly you're by yourself, but like I can work out by myself at home. I go to the gym to work out with other people, right? So there's like a team aspect to it, but you still have to, like, we have sparring today. I'm going to go do it after this podcast this afternoon, but like, I like the people I train with, but in a couple hours, I got to go fight them too. So it's like, there's a balance there of doing that. There's like learning new skills, and there's all these different ways just to kind of look at it, and all these life lessons that you take out of it. And it's just like so much more, like, I think that people see it and think it's like savagery. But to me, it's not. To me, like, there's a lot of honor in it, and I think it makes me a much better person, and I get in better shape. Yeah. This book could just kind of like summed it all up for me. I was like, that's cool. I'm kind of doing that, but I could be doing it like a little bit better, you know?
Can't we all, Scott? My third book is The Man with the Golden Typewriter, the James Bond letters of Ian Fleming. Ian Fleming, and edited by Fergus Fleming. It is, I guess, somewhat of a capstone. This year, I went heavy down the James Bond rabbit hole, for better or worse. And I found this book that Ian Fleming Publications released, And it's fascinating because a lot of the books are not just about the process by which the books got published, but the letters Fleming wrote to his fans. And I just found that fascinating because here half of them, or at least a good percentage, are saying, well, you made this mistake, that mistake, what I assume every author gets. For instance, apparently there was something where the Orient Express has vacuum brakes, not whatever he listed it as. Mm-hmm. And getting to hear his responses to those critiques, even when it's some religious group who finds James Bond distasteful. And again, remember, these books were published in the early 60s. And if you read them now, they're so tame by comparison to what's published today. But people were out every now and again. There was someone that was outraged. And he'd write to them saying, well, thank you for your letter. I appreciate your perspective. And if you can give me a detailed list of what you find distasteful, I will be happy to take it under consideration, because the last thing I want to do is alienate a large portion of the population. Or it's really things like that. And that's just not the perspective we usually have on authors, and especially Fleming. Most people want to paint him as a proto-James Bond, someone who's a sadist, smokes a lot, and abuses women and all this stuff. The reality is, yeah, he did some of that, but he was human. And consequently had his flaws and also had his good marks.
Is James Bond in the books different from James Bond in the movies?
Yes. The farther we get from the original, I would say there are a handful of movies that are very faithful to the Fleming books, but very different characters.
Huh, interesting.
I'm a fan of book Bond because I'm a book nerd first and foremost. The yeah. movies are secondary.
Right. I couldn't have guessed that you would have said that.
What? So how about audiobook? Was there a vocal performance, a narrator that you really enjoyed and really globbed onto this year?
Yeah, it's a book I just finished. It's kind of it's a Japanese novel about this swordsman named Miyamoto Musashi. And his name is, the book's called Musashi. So this is like kind of like the Japanese Gone with the Wind.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a really long audiobook. It's 53 hours and 24 minutes.
Scott, how have you not shared this with me yet?
Because I just finished it. I just finished it, like recently. It was, so I looked for this book before. Like, I remember one time I went to these fights, and my buddy was fighting, and I was cornering him, and this is the book he was reading. He was just reading the last chapter of this book before he went and fought. So I knew it was, like, I knew it was going to be a dope book. But then I heard Jocko Willink and Tim Ferriss talking about it on the Jocko podcast last year, and I was like, oh, I really have to read this book. But I went to look for it on audiobook, and there wasn't one. So apparently it got released about exactly 1 year ago from recording this in 2018. So when I went and checked on it recently, like the last couple of weeks, I found it, and I was like, no way. So I jumped on it. 53 hours long. It's by Eiji Yoshikawa. It's translated by Charles S. Terry, but the narrator is Brian Nishi. So the reason I like this book is because there's a whole bunch of Japanese characters in it, but he just does a really good job with all the voices, keeping everybody like the same. Like there's so many different people, but it's just a novel. It's about Musashi and about his life. But he was just a boy getting in a lot of trouble all the time. And by trouble, I mean, like, he ran away and then he ended up killing a bunch of people, but he wants to become like the best swordsman. And yeah, it's a super interesting book, and it's just his life. And the novel is, there's some heavy coincidences and stuff in it. So it's definitely like a story. It's not like a historical novel, but the people in the book are real people, and they are real historical things. Like, lots of these things really did happen. He really did fight the guy that he fought at the end where he fought him. And it's a really fun book. It's really fun. I loved it. This was one of those ones where I finished it a couple days ago, and then I just started listening to it again right away.
Well, thank you, because I'm always looking for something that's ideally in that 40 to 50 hour audiobook range because of the amount of driving I do. I'm definitely adding this to my list. Is this the same Mashi who wrote the Book of the Sword or the Book of Five Rings, something like
Book
that?
Book of Five Rings, yeah. So, yes, it is. Musashi, basically he lived as a swordsman when he was about, this book takes you from when he's, I think probably about 16 to 31 when he fights this, when he fights like his main rival. But he ends up being like he kills like tons of guys in the book. He's probably, I think on Wikipedia says he's like 61-0.
Oh,
yeah. Like he gets into fights. He gets into fights with he gets into fights with different schools, and he'll go there and challenge them really respectfully, and he'll fight people. But then everybody at the school will get mad because he beat the guys. And so he'll kill like 10 people at one gym. And then but then after that, then everybody's after him. Like there's people after him the whole book. He just keeps running into people. He keeps running into traps. It's just like, it's really good. But it was a serialized publication, so it came out in little sections. But it's just like, yeah, it's a really cool story. But basically after he fought Kojiro, who's like his main rival, he ended up, I think, becoming a teacher. He went into a couple different battles, and then before he died, he wrote a couple books. One was called The Book of Five Rings, and that's much more about like, it's his rules for combat pretty much, and about rules for combat with a sword. And he used this, he developed this, his own style, where he used two swords, where his main rival Kojiro had this really long sword. It was like style versus style, kind of like the early UFC days, I guess, if you wanted to compare like martial art versus martial art. But this was like real martial skill versus real martial skill. But when he got to the end of his life, he wrote two books. He wrote one that was about the Book of Five Rings. Then he wrote another one that I actually just bought in the mail. It should be here next week, but I think it's called like Dokken. And it's his rules on how to live. And judging from Wikipedia, it seems like very harsh. It's like kind of all like the harshness of Stoicism, like all wrapped, like don't have like material possessions. Like don't worry about requiring possessions and fiefdoms for your own age. Like don't try not to eat food just because it tastes good. Like all that type of stuff. So super interesting, really inspiring guy. Not for the fact that like he's killing people, but just he's just so single-minded on this quest. And there's like a romance aspect to it, except it's not like a Western romance. It's like a Japanese secret romance type of thing. And it's like, he's got to choose between like the way of, he's got to choose between like love and like finding a wife and just living this life, chasing to become the best swordsman. And it was awesome. It was awesome. I loved it.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to reading it. I can't remember what the book is, but I heard someone else say that there's a book coming out that was a serialized book. And that actually excites me, because the Count of Monte Cristo and a lot of those, what I'd consider the French classics, they started out as serialized stories, and that's part of the reason why each and every chapter is jam-packed with a beginning, middle, and end of story and epic, and making you want to read the next chapter. Something modern authors could really learn from.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's maybe why there's a lot of coincidences when people, because they're running all over Japan pretty much, and there's like 10 different people that like you kind of get into depth about, but like they all meet each other or they're all connected in some way, right?
Oh yes.
So there's just like a lot of coincidences. But I think that if you're reading that as it was published over like weeks or months or whatever it was, because it probably would have came out over like 2 years, right? There's so many chapters in it. I think that it would have seemed like those coincidences are not as, like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't seem as, oh, of course this person is the secret lover of blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because there's so much time between it. But another thing I really liked about this book, too, is that there was a lot of, like, the author used a lot of, like, animal references. So it was just, like, really cool. Like, there's, like, Musashi has to go into this fort to get his sister Ogin. They captured his sister to get him out of hiding because he had killed all these people. They wanted to capture him, but they couldn't. So they stole his sister, kept her at a fort, and he's going to go bust into it. And like, it says that he moved like an erratic dragonfly. And I really like that, but there's just a whole bunch of stuff like that. Like this little boy jumps down and it'll be like, he hopped like a frog, or like the clouds wither, or the clouds crawled like a withering serpent or something like that. And I was like, I don't know. There was a whole bunch of stuff in this book that I just really loved.
Well, I'm definitely listening to it now. You've convinced me. It sounds like a great book. I hope other people check it out too.
Cool. What's yours?
So I kind of have to talk about one book to explain the other one to a certain degree, so I apologize for that. But Mike Rowe published a book this year called The Way I Heard It. And I've listened to the podcast before. Basically, they're short stories that are kind of like Paul Harvey, where you don't know, you're trying to figure out who it is at the end. Well, Mike Rowe narrated the audiobook version of this, and it has little interstitials of a bit of autobiographical story. And he talked about a series called Travis McGee, a detective series by John D. MacDonald. And I'm a sucker for a good mystery. And I forget how much I love mystery novels until I find another great one. And I'm just immediately going, yes, Sherlock Holmes is the greatest fictional character ever written, and all of these other mystery characters are equally as good, or at least close to equally. And John D. MacDonald wrote the Travis McGee stories, and they're narrated, they're on Audible, but they're narrated by Robert Petcoff, who does a fantastic performance, giving a very... His voice isn't too high, and it isn't too low. He just has the plain everyman voice. And I find that occasionally refreshing in a book, and he does a good job narrating it. He also did... The reason I'm picking Robert Petcoff as the narrator here also is because he did a bunch of Castle novels, like Castle, the TV show, starring Nathan Fillion, Stanley Caddick. He narrates those books that are supposed to be set in the fictional world that Castle writes about, that he's following around the detective for. He does an amazing Nathan Fillion impression. So you really feel like these stories are extensions of that TV show. So he's just multi-versatile and gave excellent performances to all the books I've read so far. The female characters, it isn't that thing where you're listening to a guy try doing a girl voice and you're like, oh, please don't do that again. He actually does it in a competent way, and when they describe the voice afterwards, because of course that's what every mystery writer does, as the femme fatale walks into the room and describes her voice as slightly sultry with an element of bourbon, he actually delivers on that description.
Yeah, that's cool. I felt that same way about this Musashi book, because there's a whole bunch of, like, there's one girl named Otsu in it. And there was a couple times that I was listening to it, and then I was just like, I was so thinking, like, that's Otsu's voice. Like, I was never thinking, like, that's a guy reading this book about this girl. I was just like, oh, that's how the character sounds.
That's what I love about good vocal performances, and that is why we have this category, because sometimes audiobook narrators, it is an art form. It really is. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of room to improve. Like, I think that someone could make a real like audiobook experience. Like, I kind of feel that a lot of times people are just, they're just, I don't know, kind of selling out. Like, I think you could make like a soundscape and have like a really beautiful like background noises and stuff, like, you know, quietly in the background while the person's talking, to give a little bit of ambiance to the thing. Like, I think there's so much more room, but yeah, having a very powerful voice to guide you through the story, it should almost seem like you shouldn't, after a little bit, you should just not even, there should be nothing there except the information. Like, you shouldn't be thinking about the voice. I think that's the best when you're not even thinking about the narrator.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, so a slight comment on that. If you ever, I'm not certain if you're a Star Wars fan, but the Star Wars audiobooks are hands down some of the greatest productions I have ever heard. At least the good ones. There are definitely bad ones, but in general, what they do is they include all of the sound effects. It has, like, when it's in space and they're walking down the bridge. Yeah, you hear like the little sounds of space. You hear the tinkling of the sound of the computers in the background. Mm-hmm. And some of the guys they hire to do these voices, especially considering a lot of the books, they're doing voices of people that are like, well, Han Solo and Harrison Ford. Very iconic voices that are distinctive. James Earl Jones as Darth Vader, very distinctive. And I'm sure they're, at least in the case of the Darth Vader ones, they do a little bit of audio trickery to get that effect. But in general, like, even Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker, they nail the voice. They pick narrators who can nail the voice just perfectly. And they include all those sound effects. They have a little... It starts out with the bum, ba-da-dum. So, if you're looking for that complete audio experience, I do recommend checking out specifically the first of the Thrawn trilogy. I think it's called Heir to the Empire. That, in my opinion, is the best one.
Nice. That's really cool.
Well, Scott, thank you again for joining us for our 2019 Best Books. Do you have anything you would like to plug to the audience as they go forward into a new year?
Nope, just my YouTube channel, I suppose. You can check me out on there. I'm at Scott Hebert. I'm pretty much haven't really been using social media that much lately, so YouTube is the best place to find me. Hopefully, I'll still be posting videos by the time this is out.
I sincerely hope so.
Who knows what I'll be up to by then?
I don't know what Canadian weather looks like right now.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good.
Well, thank you again for joining us on the show, Scott.
All right, thanks for having me.
Big thanks again to Scott for joining us on the show today. Always a great conversation. Be sure to check out all the books we've recommended, but additionally, I also want to plug three books from show guests we had here in 2019. Dr. Nasha Winters, her book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. Mark Shepard's Restoration Agriculture, and he just published a new book with Acres USA called Water on Any Farm. And lastly, Bob Quinn's book, Grain by Grain, which was a very enjoyable read for me this year. These are all great books, and I hope that if you haven't read any of them, that you'll get a copy from wherever books are sold. Thanks again for another great year on the podcast. Thank you for listening. If you're new to the show, please subscribe, whatever your podcast player of choice is. While you are there, be sure to leave us a nice review, letting others know how great the show is. Until 2020, this has been Terrence Lehew and the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast, reminding you to keep farming the dream.
What was that? Far in the mountains.